WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, August 25th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. 16 years after 9/11 and the start of George W. Bush's war on terror, the United States is still fighting in Afghanistan. On Monday, in an address to the nation, President Trump explained why he has changed his mind about withdrawing American troops from the country.
My original instinct was to pull out. And historically, I like following my instincts.
He goes on to define his policy as principled realism.
The stronger the Afghan security forces become, the less we will have to do. Afghans will secure and build their own nation and define their own future. We want them to succeed. But we will no longer use American military might to construct democracies in faraway lands or try to rebuild other countries in our own image. Those days are now over. Instead, we will work with allies and partners to protect our shared interests.
David Rowe joins me to discuss his years as a reporter in Afghanistan, his 7 months as a hostage of the Taliban, and how these experiences have shaped his thinking about the war. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I was listening to Donald Trump, and this sounds like a reasonable strategy. If you set aside the history we're all familiar with now, it's actually quite similar to the policy Obama pursued for 8 years. Yet, Afghanistan seems no closer to defeating the Taliban and establishing a working state. Just two days ago, I almost missed a story in the Times. It was, what, five paragraphs with the Taliban attacked an Afghan army convoy and killed seven people. This is now, has been routine for all these years. You described our involvement in the country this week on NewYorker.com as a halfway war. What did you mean by that?
Well, what you see today is this kind of the product of a constantly reversing American effort. There were very few troops in Afghanistan under George W. Bush. Obama went up to well over 100,000 troops, but before he left office, you know, he brought the troop levels to the current level, which is roughly 8,000. So yes, things look very bad. The Taliban are gaining. They're controlling the largest number of districts they have since 2001. And what Trump has adopted is a slight increase in troops that, frankly, won't really change that dynamic.
And what about the airstrikes? That was another thing that really characterized Obama's policy to reduce American casualties.
He had restricted airstrikes to reduce civilian casualties. There was a lot more checks and balances on the targeting that went on. And he also limited the amount of air support the U.S. Would supply to Afghan forces. This was sort of a tough love approach to get the Afghans to stand up on their own. That has not gone well. And Trump is going to, I think, allow a looser use of air support. There's a danger that more civilians will die, but it will definitely help Afghan security forces who are just overwhelmed in a lot of these remote parts of the country.
You've been covering the story since really before the war began, and we're sitting right now in The New Yorker's office in One World Trade Center. We're overlooking the site of the 9/11 attacks. Take us from that day to your time as a reporter in Kabul.
Well, I was, frankly, a local Metropolitan News reporter for The Times on 9/11. I actually heard the first plane hit the North Tower here from Brooklyn and jumped on a subway and came here and the towers fell and was sent to Afghanistan 2 weeks later. I was there when Kabul fell. There was genuine rejoicing among the vast majority of Afghans. They really did loathe the Taliban. Most Afghans still don't support the Taliban, particularly ones who live in the cities. They love the change. They want to be modern and part of the world. But it's been a disappointing 16 years. The changes we hoped for haven't happened. And the halfway war means that it's this American effort that isn't enough to win, but we're not willing to pull out. Essentially, we have a very, very costly effort to stop another 9/11. And the burden right now is vast majority of deaths are Afghans.
And we did succeed for a time in driving the Taliban out. Then what happened?
They regrouped in Pakistan. There's many problems with Afghanistan. The core problem is corruption in the Afghan government itself. And the second problem has been Pakistan has sheltered and aided and supported the Taliban consistently for the last 16 years. Every American president has told them to stop doing this. We've threatened to slow down or reduce the amount of military aid we've been supplying to Pakistan. It was cut off at one point by Obama, and the Pakistanis have denied helping the Taliban, and the status quo continues. We can't defeat the Taliban as long as they can have safe havens in Pakistan.
I think at the time you were working on a book about the Helmand province in southern Afghanistan. Could you talk a little bit about what you thought the book was going to be about and what the situation was on the ground at the time?
So in 2008, you know, there was a real belief among reporters there and I think diplomats and aid workers that the U.S. invaded in 2001. The Bush administration got distracted by Iraq in 2003, and there really hadn't been a serious effort. And Obama in 2008 and 2009 was hopefully going to bring out this big surge, and a surge would work. He did a large surge, but he also announced he was going to pull out the vast majority of U.S. troops within a set amount of time. And I think the Taliban just waited him out. I think that was a sort of fatal mistake of the Obama surge. And then I have a bias here in terms of the role of Pakistan and these safe havens. While I was researching that book, for the first time in my, I guess it was 6 or 7 years covering the war in Afghanistan, I decided to interview a Taliban commander. He had done interviews before, twice with a French television journalist, once with a Greek television journalist, and not kidnap them. And he kidnapped me just outside of Kabul when I went to meet him for an interview and was able to quickly move me across several provinces of Afghanistan and into the tribal areas of Pakistan. And that's where I was held for 7 months with an Afghan journalist and an Afghan driver.
And talk just for a moment about that province. This helps to explain what you were just saying about Pakistan's policy toward the Taliban. They basically ceded that area to terrorists.
Yeah, it's been a lawless area for decades. The United States used that same area to fund the Mujahideen, the Afghans, to fight the Soviet forces in Afghanistan in the 80s, and now, ironically, it's reversed. So I was taken there, and I was amazed. Essentially, a Taliban mini-state exists in the mountains of Pakistan. We defeated them in Kabul, but they simply reestablished their own little emirate. They run the schools, they improve the roads, they have, like, local police forces. And there was no effort that I saw in the 7 months I was there by Pakistani military forces. There are a few bases to ever come off their bases and actually confront the Taliban. I thought there would be some fear or some effort by the Pakistanis to confront them, but it's a fully functioning state. It's still there. Well, the one thing that kind of limits their operations are American drone strikes. U.S. forces do not cross the border, come into Pakistan and carry out raids. It's a huge frustration for American generals. I would include probably the National Security Advisor McMaster and Defense Secretary Mattis. Taliban would come over the border into Afghanistan, kill Americans, go back over the border into Pakistan, and U.S. forces couldn't pursue them.
What did your captors want?
They were obsessed with direct negotiations with the United States and legitimacy. They very much wanted to negotiate with Richard Holbrooke, who was then the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan at the State Department. You could see that as rational, but they're also irrational. It was a harrowing and jarring experience. I had one conversation with the senior intelligence official of the Taliban faction that had me, and I said, well, can't you have kind of strict Sharia Islamic law, what you want, in certain parts of Afghanistan, but in Kabul, which is, you know, actually a very cosmopolitan place, couldn't they have a different interpretation there or a different set of rules there? And, you know, he shook his head and said, no, that God doesn't judge us as individuals. He said he would be judged if he didn't act to stop sinning. So if there's one person in a village or a city that's sinning, every resident goes to hell because they didn't stop the sin themselves. They think they're winning. They think it's their religious duty to do this, and they think they can just wait out the United States. And to be frank, that strategy is working.
Tell us a little bit more about these conversations you had with your captors, some of whom were somewhat sympathetic. You did have these very interesting exchanges of views, and you learned a little bit more about how they see the American occupation.
So there were guards who saw that there was corruption in the Taliban ranks, that there were senior commanders kind of brainwashing young men to go kill themselves as suicide bombers. I could sense in some of these conversations, younger Taliban saw that the older leaders were sort of using religion to get power, political power and fame to run the movement. But there were others that were totally brainwashed. They were convinced that Americans and Westerners in general sort of fear death, that we're not religious, where they embrace death. And they were convinced that there was this, that the 9/11 attacks were staged, that the U.S. military was forcing Afghans to convert to Christianity, that Afghan women were being forced to work as prostitutes. There was something in the news, there were newspapers around, old ones, Pakistani newspapers, and there was pictures of Afghans wearing neckties, Western neckties. And this young suicide bomber I met said, isn't a necktie a secret symbol of Christianity?
Wow. Wow. They also think it's just a general war on Muslims.
They believe they are defending their faith from a global conspiracy by Christians, Hindus, and Jews to obliterate Islam from the face of the earth. There's constant propaganda videos they want, but it is an alternate reality, and it was stunning to sort of live there for 7 months.
You were in daily fear that you were going to be killed. What happened finally to secure your release?
To be honest, I was afraid in the beginning, but it became very clear to me, and I was lucky in a way that the faction that had me wanted money or prisoners. So I was more worried they were going to harm the Afghans I was with, which they'd done in other cases. But we were able to essentially, this Afghan journalist, Tahir Luddin, who was kidnapped with me, said we'd moved close to a nearby Afghan military base. And while our guards were asleep one night, we were able to use a rope and go up on a roof and lower ourselves down a wall. And then Tahir was able, he had, sometimes would go out with the guards to get food and other things. He was guided me through the darkness to that base. We almost got shot when we walked up to a checkpoint and tried to surrender to get on the base. And again, there was a young 20-odd-year-old Pakistani army captain, a moderate Muslim, heard from the radio that there were these two journalists standing out there who claimed they'd been kidnapped, an American and an Afghan, and he let us in immediately. First thing he did was apologize to me, he said, as a Pakistani, as a Muslim, for our kidnapping. So they're out there. We have allies.
Were there attempts by the U.S. to rescue you?
There were no military raids. There was a small amount of money offered as a ransom by the New York Times. I've mentioned this. I haven't disclosed the amount, and I won't because I don't want to create an incentive for, you know, any journalist to be kidnapped. The Taliban laughed at that amount. They wanted $25 million in the beginning and 15 prisoners from Guantanamo. And the tragic thing is that soon after I was able to escape with this Afghan's help, they captured Bo Bergdahl, the American soldier, and the exact same faction, they're called the Haqqani Network, was able to hold Bo Bergdahl for 5 years in Pakistan. It's outrageous. How could the Pakistani government allow that to go on? There was all this criticism of Bergdahl for the prisoners that were released, for him to be released. But the primary blame in that case is the government of Pakistan.
And Trump did address that in his speech. He was very critical of Pakistan's policies. Do you expect any of that to change?
No, because he's the third president who's made these sort of empty threats. We cooperate with Pakistan and continue to give them, and we've given them nearly $20 billion in military aid. It's about $1 billion a year because they allow us to carry out our drone strikes over Pakistani airspace. It's a stalemate. We're taking out bomb makers. We take out commanders here and there, but more and more recruits join them. It just grinds on and on and on.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You listened to Trump during the campaign, and he really doesn't tend to differentiate between terrorists and other Muslims who are peace-loving. Talk a little bit about how that feels, given where you've come from.
Well, it was really jarring on two levels. And one level was this idea that if we just take the gloves off, that if we hit these guys hard enough, they're somehow going to get afraid and stop fighting. They are brainwashed into wanting to die. They want to die. That whole idea of using more deadly force, it's not going to work. And then the second thing was he completely missed that the vast majority of Afghans, you know, don't support the Taliban. I mentioned in the piece, it's astonishing now. The death rate is incredible. Last year, 6,000 Afghan soldiers died fighting the Taliban. At the same time last year, a total of 14 American soldiers did. The numbers are up now. The numbers are higher this year. On average, 31 Afghan soldiers are dying per day in Afghanistan. And there's roughly 9 or 10 Afghan civilians dying. Most of the civilian deaths are from Taliban suicide attacks. So we have Muslim allies. This is a civil war across the Middle East for the future of Islam, and we should be recognizing those allies, supporting them through training, and they have to lead the fight, but they exist. So travel bans on Muslims, attacking American Muslims, falsely claiming that they don't report terrorist attacks, which is not true, is helping the cause of the extremists. It's not a war on Islam.
You wrote a stunning series for the New York Times after you got back, and one of the really striking moments to me was when, in one of your conversations with your captors, you describe being forced to sit and sing with them at night, basically to alleviate some of the boredom.
So again, I mean, these are young men. They're bored. They're sitting around guarding me and the two Afghans who had been kidnapped with me. And frankly, they hated the Afghans more than they hated me. They saw any Afghan or Pakistani that was sort of working with either government as a traitor to Islam. But, you know, we would sing. They had me sing these Taliban songs. They had one song where the main lyric was, you have atomic bombs, but we have suicide bombers. And then we sang a Beatles song. So there was one night where I kind of led them, and I won't sing for listeners here, I promise. I don't want to make you go through that. We sang the song, She Loves You.
Hostage-taking is one of the outgrowths of the war on terror, and at the moment we're seeing the relatively new development of ISIS driving cars into crowds in Europe, killing as many civilians as they can. Is the West winning this thing, or are we just encouraging further acts of terror?
I think we are. I think the fact, and again, there's a theme here, Iraqi forces led the successful retaking of Mosul. It was some of the worst fighting, house-to-house fighting in the world since World War II. Frankly, again, Trump is not congratulating the brave Iraqis that are our allies and the key to this whole thing. So as ISIS's territory shrinks, they'll be less powerful. They're not able to bring in young men and brainwash them. The key thing is having safe havens where you can brainwash people. So I think we are making headway. I think there will be disgruntled, delusional, primarily young men who carry out these terrible attacks, but we can't ignore it and we can't be hopeless. And I think training forces over time and having U.S. advisors, that's what worked in Iraq with retaking Mosul. That's a model. It's patience. It's small numbers of troops, you know, thousands, tens of thousands. It's not massive invasions with 100,000 troops as we tried under George W. Bush.
But as you also point out in the piece, the toll on Afghans is enormous. So basically, we're training them to be cannon fodder.
Yeah, I just raised the moral question, which is, you know, if we're going to have a halfway war, as long as there's this safe haven in Pakistan, we're not going to win this. But it makes political sense for every American president. You keep some presence in Afghanistan because if there is another attack right here at Ground Zero in Times Square, any city in the United States, and it emanates from Afghanistan, that's a huge political disaster for any American president. And Trump has come to that conclusion as well.
Yesterday, you introduced me to a young Afghan friend of yours who has a food truck now in New York City. Could you talk a little bit about him and what his story is?
Sure. He was a driver and sort of and also a kind of reporter for the New York Times bureau there in Kabul when I worked there. He was kidnapped in a separate case of another New York Times journalist that was different from my own.
By the way, I think it's worth pausing right there because
sure.
It's another example of we all focus on the American
Correct.
Journalists and others who are kidnapped, but often their fixers and others are kidnapped with them and treated horrendously.
In that case, they were grabbed. The driver was able to sort of run off into a field immediately and warn others about the kidnapping, the driver who's here now. There was an Afghan translator that stayed with the New York Times journalist. He was a British citizen. There was a raid by British commandos to rescue them during that kidnapping. The Taliban fled, and Sultan Munadi was the name of that local Afghan journalist who was kidnapped with the New York Times correspondent. Sultan was leading the British journalist out of the house after the Taliban fled. They were afraid. There was lots of gunfire around them. And Sultan, he raised his hands, stepped out from a side wall, leading Steve to safety, Steve, the British journalist, and he shouted, I'm a journalist, I'm a journalist. And he was shot. And it turned out it was based on the angle of the rifle. It was shot from someone lying on the ground. It looks like it was a British sniper who was, you know, trying to rescue them. There is a tremendous Afghan cost. A British Special Forces soldier died in that rescue operation as well. The British journalist did make it home, but it was at a huge cost. Jamshed, after escaping and warning the New York Times bureau chief about the kidnapping, you know, he was able to eventually get a visa and come here. So Jamshed's been here for the last 8 years working. He got political asylum. He was blamed by the Taliban for the British raid because he escaped and was, you know, gave the location. His family was threatened. He was threatened. So he's worked here diligently for 8 years. He's applied for citizenship. His application, which should be processed, I'm not sure, but roughly in 6 months, has been going on for 2 years.
How will the Trump policy affect people like Jamshed who are helping American troops and journalists?
There's a huge problem where there aren't enough visas for Iraqis who translate for U.S. forces and for Afghans who translate for U.S. forces. So, again, we only win this with Muslim allies. And when we vilify them and, you know, do travel bans, the travel ban, the initial travel ban actually applied to Iraq. We were not going to give any visas to Iraqis, and Iraq has suffered far more than Afghanistan, far higher casualty rates. Trump changed that at the urging of the generals in his cabinet because it hurts the war effort. This is just exactly what extremists want. They want this to be a religious war. They want Muslims to see, look, Americans, Christians are treated this way by the United States. Look at how Muslims are treated. Join us.
You mentioned that while you were there, there was conversation about potential peace talks with the Taliban. Is that remotely plausible at this point?
I think it is plausible, and I think it's all about getting Pakistan. Russia has sort of been backing the Taliban, and some Americans suspect. And Iran is very happy to be backing the Taliban. Those three countries, Pakistan, Iran, and Russia, are eager to see the U.S. fail in Afghanistan. So you can bolster military force. You want to make it clear to the Taliban and their Pakistani backers that they can't win militarily, but you need a diplomatic initiative. And Secretary of State Tillerson just eliminated the office in the State Department of the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. The administration's promising a diplomatic effort, but you need diplomats. You can't be slashing your State Department budget and cutting offices there. So I think there is a possibility, if you work with the countries and you make the Taliban part of the government, you give them some things, I mean, I'm with limits, you could possibly stabilize the country.
And yet, given their extremism, what would the country look like?
Look, young Afghans, they're proud of being Muslim and modern. They want to be like Dubai. They talk about Istanbul, but they don't want to go back. They don't want to have vice and virtue police running around whipping people if they don't have long enough beards, and they don't want women to be blocked from education. So it's difficult. The idea is if you negotiate with the Taliban, maybe you can split them. There's some of them that, you know, if they see the war is going to drag on for years and the Afghan security forces getting better training and getting some helicopters and maybe planes to help, that will bring them to the bargaining table. I don't know if this is going to work. It has been a haphazard American effort, huge surge by Obama, and then he wanted to pull all the troops out and couldn't do it in the end. So we'll see what Trump does, but it does look like more of the same.
Thank you so much, David.
Thank you.
David Rode is the news director of NewYorker.com and the co-author with Kristen Mulvihill of A Rope and a Prayer, The Story of a Kidnapping. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Jill Duboff for NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.